Harry King's vast mansion was well protected and a perfect place for a private dinner where the Low King and Vetinari could meet while preparations were being made for the long haul to Überwald. It was widely considered that Harry's undertakers had the jump on your average soldier or policeman when it came to a scrap, because those people had been taught to have rules, while most of Harry's boys couldn't even spell the word. Any intruder foolish enough to be found lurking in the shrubbery of Harry's extensive estate in the dark and the dripping rain would be pruned in no short order. Even though this was a private dinner, Effie King was not going to let the side down. She had begun her preparations for the meal with a headache and then moved on to a dither before segueing into an organisation of military precision and dimensions, bullying the cooks on the way and frantically looking up such things as what spoon you used with what soup. Effie genuflected deeply to the Low King as he arrived in her oak-panelled dining room, and Effie was in a more expensive and acceptable version of Hog Heaven. "How was your journey, sire? Safe and comfortable?" The Low King hesitated for a moment. "It's Euphemia, isn't it?" he said. Effie was on fire. "Yes, Your Majesty, but just Effie to you." The King smiled again. "Very good, and I'm Your Majesty to you, Lady King." Effie looked somewhat challenged until the King of the Dwarfs held out his hand and said, "Actually, you can call me anything you like. I was just trying to make an old dwarf joke, just like myself right now, a fugitive trying to avoid even more dangerous fugitives and reliant on the help of others, such as your noble husband and his friends." Moist smiled as the noble penny dropped on Effie. The King now looked around the other guests. He smiled at Commander Vimes and Lady Sybil and shook hands with Adora Bell, who was, Moist thought proudly, a real looker when she wasn't in her work clothes. And from what he could see, she had bought a most attractive and therefore expensive gown for the evening. It was still grey, of course, but with a kind of lustre to it that made it seem almost festive. This was Grey letting its hair down. He couldn't possibly argue about it. She earned more than he did. The King's eyes scouted the room, and he continued, "And Lord Vetinari will be joining us? And Mr. Simnel, the technical genius behind your remarkable railway?" Harry looked around, just as Lord Vetinari stepped forward from the shadows in the room. At least, that's where Moist assumed he'd come from. Vetinari was one of the greatest students of concealment the assassins had ever produced, so it could simply have been a shadowy state of mind. Stepped forward from the shadows in the room and got there first and rather more smoothly. "Your Majesty, welcome to Ankh-Morpork. Mr. Simnel is overseeing the final preparations for the locomotive that will get you back to your home and throne in time. Nothing is being left to chance, I can assure you." "Ah, Lord Vetinari, I didn't see you, forgive me," replied Rhys, and Moist nearly choked on his drink when he continued, "But I understand there's still some track to lay and bridges that need to be completed." He paused. "Rather close to our intended destination, I believe." Moist felt the air chill instantly. He quickly scanned the faces of Harry and Vetinari and jumped in. After all, it was what he was there for. "Excuse me, Your Majesty, but Mr. Simnel has developed a concept called Loggy Sticks, the nature of which is enshrined in the phrase, first things first. Of course, the trick is to know exactly what needs to be first, and right now, since you are many days away from Überwald, the gangs still have time to complete the last few sections. You will get to Überwald for the appointed time, I'll stake my life on that." There was a silence that froze the air in the room, and Moist counted down to the inevitable comment from a smiling Lord Vetinari. "Most gratifying, Mr. Lipwig. And you have made that promise in front of all of us. Good show. And all good people here with quite excellent memories." After that, the first person to speak was Adora Bell, who said, "Oh, that's definitely my husband, but I'm sure he'll manage it at the last possible minute. He always does. And if he can achieve it while riding a white charger, he'll be as happy as a clam." The King laughed in a rather strange way and said, "Well then, let's hope that he is not unduly shucked." "Your Majesty, Mr. Lipwig always achieves his goals, I assure you," said Lord Vetinari, in his best oiled voice. "I find it amazing, and of course annoying, but so far he has always succeeded, which is why, therefore, all of his extremities are in their rightful place." Everybody present laughed nervously, except Lord Vetinari, who just laughed. The King of the Dwarfs stared at Moist as if seeing him in a new light, and said, "Is that really true, Mr. Litvig?" Moist forced his face to go so deadpan that it might have actually been dead. "Yes, Your Majesty, everything that ought to be attached still is. Isn't that right, Adorabelle?" His wife didn't say anything. She just looked the look of a wife who was putting up with her husband's funny little ways, for which he would suffer in the boudoir later. After that, Effie beamed anxiously and said, in a voice that she considered posh people would use, "Shall we take our seats for dinner, Your Majesty, ladies and gentlemen? All these spoons are in their rightful place, I do assure you." Conversation around the dinner table, in deference to Effie and the flapping ears of the staff, was nice, and mostly about the new railway and the wonders of what might be achieved with it, and indeed the interesting fact that lots of rich people were buying seaside houses in Quirm now that it was so easy to get there. And there was also another careful conversation about how good the fish and the seafood was becoming now it didn't have to bake in the sunshine, which might have had something to do with the mountainous platter of prawns, monkey clams, and unidentified tentacular things sculpted to resemble the lost citadel of Leshp, which Effie had given pride of place in the centre of the table. And this went on in various different ways until dinner was almost over and the staff had left the room, whereupon Vimes gave Rhys a quizzical look, stood up and left the room. He returned a few minutes later, nodded to the Low King, and resumed his seat at the table. "Ladies and gentlemen, preparations for our departures are in place. As I speak, the Low King is departing by fast coach for Uberwald." And there was something in the way that he said that that made Moist think, because the Low King, at that moment, was clearly still in the room, shovelling down expensive ice cream. Sure enough, there was the sound of a coach pulling up outside, stopping for a moment, and then driving away, surrounded by well-armed bodyguards. Back at the table, the King licked his spoon in a very regal way and chuckled. "That should keep those scoundrels busy for a while," he smiled at Vimes. "Thank you for your help in this, Commander." "Think nothing of it," said Vimes gruffly. "It's a good idea. And Harry and I have added some embellishments of our own." "So who was on that coach, Commander?" Moist asked. "The coach," Vimes replied. "This is a very dark night, and the King is cloaked, and it is almost impossible to see inside, but the dark, accustomed eye might see Sergeant's cheery little bottom, accompanied by some of my most trusted dwarf officers. Anybody interfering with the coach and its contents will find their life difficult, nay, extinct." The King coughed before saying to Vimes, "I remember Sergeant Littlebottom when we met by the Scone of Stone 8 years ago. Oh, yes, I remember her." "She volunteered for the job, sire," said Vimes. "She did she?" said the King. "Well, none of us know what the future holds, but if my backside is still on the Scone when all of this is over, then Sergeant Littlebottom and her colleagues will have earned any favours they want from me. A king's gratitude has to be worth something, wouldn't you say, Blackboard Monitor Vimes?" Vimes smiled, as if remembering an old joke, and said, "Well, I hope she does, because she's one of the best officers I've got." "How many cheery Littlebottoms can you afford?" The King looked sombre. "I'd hate for someone to die, just to see that I don't. Now, if I am to get to Uberwald with all due speed, we shall be leaving very soon, yes?" "Soon, Your Majesty," Vimes agreed. "The rail traffic between here and Stolat runs throughout the night. At present it's mostly freight and perishables for the market and the post office parcel business, but people are always coming and going at the terminus. Nobody could keep track of everyone. We've set it up so that you'll be just another anonymous traveller on the platform, looking like any one of the third-class passengers, although, should the need arise, you and your travelling companions would be found to be carrying an inordinately large amount of deadly weaponry. and that, Your Majesty, includes fangs. The watch is not going to be outdone on this one, sire. If the excrement hits the what's name, nearly every place you go will have people watching you. Now, if you and Mr. Lipvig will accompany me to the side room over there, we'll make sure that neither of you looks like either of you by the time we've finished. Turning to Harry, the commander said, Harry, are you sure you can vouch for the discretion of all your people, even those in the kitchens? Harry almost saluted. Yes, Commander, some of them are scoundrels. Well, you know, but they're my kind of scoundrel. Ah, yes, said the King. I'm used to that sort of scoundrel. They're also very useful. Moist knew a lot about the tricks of disguise, although he never bothered with makeup as such. Becoming another person was a subtle matter that was probably only understood by those wrinkled old men up in the very high mountains around Oi Dong, who knew the secrets of the known universe, one of them being how to kick your enemy's spine all the way out of their body. They certainly knew that true camouflage came from within, and oh yes, an occasional change of clothes was warranted, but mostly Moist just thought about the type of person he wanted to be seen as, and it all came into focus. A false nose was definitely a no-no. Inevitably, any nose designed to make you look like a stranger would be noticeably strange. And why risk it, when his own features were so unmemorable that no one recalled their shape in any case? Of course, trying to look female had some built-in snags, but he'd managed it on a few occasions back in the bad old days, which were, in retrospect, so damn good, and he had lost track of all the clergymen he had been. If there was such a thing as redemption, they would have to open a magnum of the stuff for Moist. No, a brewery. The King's party split up when they arrived at the station. Rhys, now disguised as a rather disorientated elderly dwarf, was accompanied at a distance by three other disreputable-looking characters, while the rest of his party disposed themselves in small, innocuous-looking groups along the platform. Bashful Bashfulson had gallantly volunteered as another bodyguard, but both Moist and Commander Vimes had considered him too recognisable to other dwarfs, here in his native Ankh Morpork, and suggested his special skills could be made better use of elsewhere. The Dark Clerks, however, had been trained by Vetinari, who, as he had so recently proved, could stand in a room full of people without being seen. It was a technique. And there were others, quite probably overhead. Whatever happened, Commander Vimes was not going to have the low King of the Dwarfs killed on his watch. Moist sighed as he walked, dragging one leg pitifully, but not too pitifully, to the rear of the train. There he found a station guard berating a well-dressed man who had sat down firmly in the third-class carriage among sleepy workers with greasy hands and bags of tools, and chimney sweeps with, of course, their sacks of soot inevitably leaking. Moist was all for the common man, and most especially the common man who could have afforded at least one bar of soap over a lifetime, and possibly didn't spit all the time, great hawking globs of spit, the ones with a personality of their own. And the toff, who reeked and dribbled best brandy, was holding up the train while the guard was dithering, derailed by a haughty voice. And so Moist put an arm around the wretched man and went straight into his infuriating drunk routine, complete with explosive belches, a sure-fire winner guaranteed to work every time. First there was the spittle in the corner of the mouth, and a nasty smell which Moist was king of, and a conversation in which every word was shredded and mistreated and misapplied unto death, while Moist leaned inappropriately and spat and dribbled. The wretch hurried for the sole first-class compartment at the front of the train after less than a minute. A personal best for Moist, who, still in dribbling and stinking character, staggered and weaved his way to a seat just before the whistle was blown and the train moved in the half-hearted way trains always did as the engine got its act together. He was very proud of it, and he'd only used up half of his boffo's best artificial vomit with lingering smell. It was a cold night for travelling. The King was on board somewhere, but this wasn't the time to show any interest in him. Moist's ragged clothes had been, well, adequate, and everybody in the compartment with the wind whistling underneath them had wrapped themselves up and tried not to exist until the train had reached its destination. Somewhere, he thought, there should be a statue erected to Effie, who had clearly tongue-lashed her husband into making the lower-class coaches at least waterproof. The only carriages that were open to the weather were the ones for those extra-large passengers, mostly trolls, who couldn't fit inside anything else. And that was because they were, in fact, the coal cars. No one minded. Trolls were impervious to rain, which helped them to cultivate a better quality of lichen in any case, and the coal doubled as a welcome snack during the journey. The leader of the Delvers, watching one of the main routes out of Ankh Morpork, smiled as the large coach bearing the Low King's insignia came into view. Rain splashed over the coach as the horses galloped hubwards, and the leader of the Delvers smiled at the raindrops. How easy it was going to be. He gave the signal to the waiting dwarfs, and within minutes they were grabbing harnesses and bridles and bringing the coach to a shuddering halt. He kicked the coach door open. "Bring out your king, and you will not be harmed," he commanded. There was silence inside the coach, and then he heard a voice say, "We ain't got no king apart from Harry King, and we ain't the ones that are going to get harmed. Consider us as the King Preservation Society, and Sir Harry King don't like his friends being put to any trouble. And so you, my son, you are a lot of trouble, but thankfully not as much as we are. Come on, lads." The fight was fast and methodical, and the coach drove away with the victors singing and drinking in the storm, and the water on the cobbles was tinged with red. Meanwhile, a few miles away, another group of Delvers was having a remarkably similar experience with a remarkably similar coach, which turned out to contain, amongst other horrors, a very fierce, very female dwarf in a watchman's helmet. The train pulled into the station at Stowlat Junction, and Moist watched as the guard helped a grubby and pitiful old dwarf down from his carriage. The Low King clearly had some skill as an actor. Moist noticed one of the old dwarf's equally decrepit companions in adversity take pity on him and give him a piece of dwarf bread, breaking it in half with his axe. To his horror, Moist saw the king dribbling his thanks to the bread-giver. As he came up to the king, Moist whispered, "Excellent! Where did you get that stink? It's got a life of its own!" The king put a finger to his lips and said, "Not me. It leaked from the man in front. I don't think he could have washed for years. But, remember, a king has to cope with a lot worse than a little stink." There were a few hours to kill before the fast train left Stowlat for Zemphis, as yet the furthest point hubwards to enjoy a hygienic railway service. Getting the Low King out of sight was a priority. Even in disguise, there was a risk. Leaving Simnel and Vimes in charge at the station, Moist and the Low King limped their way outside. Moist looked around for people he knew had to be there because he couldn't see them. Suddenly, one of them was right in front of him, so close that they were almost touching. He hadn't seen him until that moment. It was as if he had shot up from below. "Godfrey, Mr. Lipwig, Dark Clark. Lord Vetinari has arranged for a safe house to be available to your party. Mr. Simnel suggested his mother's house, which isn't far away. We've met the lady, and she is a royalist through and through. Any royalty, and sensible too. Nothing to worry about there. Clark Mavis says the old girl is quick on the uptake and understands the position. She is a good cook, and there will be clean sheets." Moist looked at the dripping king, who smiled and said, "It sounds like a gift from Tack on a night like this." As they walked the short distance through the rain-drenched and deserted streets to Mrs. Simnel's house, Moist was always aware of their escorts, because the little hairs on the back of his neck were telling him they were there, showing them the way. Before long, they reached a cheerful little house near the centre of town, the kind that was always referred to as a little palace, the kind a lad might buy for his widowed mother so she could be close for doing the shopping. A discreet knock at the door caused some shuffling within before a lady who could only be Mr. Simnel's mother stood in the doorway, quietly ushering them inside. Once they were in her small but immaculate house, she paused and looked down at the Low King, then curtsied. "Thank you so much, my dear Mrs. Simnel," said the king, who had clearly dealt with these things many times before. "No need for that from the mother of the genius engineer." And Mrs. Simnel was suddenly awash with maternal pride. "Oh, yes, Your Majesty, he's a good lad, our Dick. Did you know that when he were quite young, he made me an iconograph, caught the imp himself, so he did, and trained it with butter? They really like butter, do imps, and it's ever so useful, yes indeed." While Clark Godfrey, on flannel feet, quickly checked the rest of the house, Mrs. Simnel turned to Moist and said, "I know you too. You're Mr. Litvig. Dick speaks very highly of you. I saw your picture in the paper only yesterday, and I've seen our Dick in there too. Makes an old mum reet proud, so it does. Of course, I don't buy it. The Reverend Amusable comes round and reads the paper to me, what with that tiny print and all. I don't get around as much these days, but now my lad is in the money, he has all kind of food delivered up fresh every day on the train, and sees his old mum all right. The other day, ooh, it were a lobster in a bag of ice. I had to go all the way up to posh restaurant to find out how to cook it. But it were gradely and toothsome, and so much on it there was enough for Mrs. Pankweather, who's bedbound and can't digest most things. But you should have seen her tooth light up when she saw a plate full of lobster. Well, you have to, after all. Not every elderly lady has a good strong lad to see she's all right." Mrs. Simnel suddenly looked sombre and said, "But he sends me money every week regular, so much I don't rightly know what to do with it, so I give some of it to the poor. You are a friend of his, aren't you, Mr. Litvig?"
"Yes, Mrs. Simnel," said Moist. "You can't imagine how much."
At this point, Clark Godfrey said, "We are now going back to the marshalling yard to assist Mr. Vimes and the other members of the watch, who will be travelling with us on the long haul to Oberwald. Clark's Columbine and Silkworm will remain outside and will escort you back to the station in time to catch the train to Zemphis." And then he was gone. Mrs. Simnel looked again at the bedraggled king and said with unconscious informality, "You look famished, pet. I know it's late, but I've got some peas pudding in pot. Not much, but it keeps you going, and it'll build up your strength when you most need it." As it turned out, Mrs. Simnel's peas pudding was the queen of peas puddings, and even though the dinner at Harry's had only been a few hours earlier, Moist noticed that the king almost sucked it up. When they'd eaten, Mrs. Simnel put the lid back on the pot. "I've got to leave some for my lad," she said, "out in all this weather. Mind you, he likes his peas pudding cold." And then the king settled into a comfy chair for a snooze. While he slept and Mrs. Simnel busied herself clearing the dishes, Moist looked around at the walls and noticed carefully arranged pictures of smiling babies. Or was it just one baby taken over and over? Because he thought, at that age all babies look like, well, babies, and only mothers could fathom which one was which. It was amazing. "My word, Mrs. Simnel, what wonderful children," Moist commented when she returned to wish him good night. "All yours?" She laughed. "Oh, dear me, no. Our Dick's my only one. But I were trained as a midwife before I met my late husband, and you know how it is. I were right good at midwifery, and especially when events were going badly." And here she looked sternly at Moist and said, "I'm sure you know what I mean, Mr. Litvig. I only ever lost one because they couldn't find my whereabouts until it were too late. Any road, ever since then, people call me out, and you know how it is. My lad says I don't have to do it any more, but once you've got a reputation for something, it clings. Especially when the young lass is desperate." The look of Mrs. Simnel was that of the put-upon, but in her eyes pride flashed a fin. Snoring heavily in the huge armchair, the king turned over. Mrs. Simnel adjusted the deep cushions to make him more comfortable, and then there was a fleeting stillness as her attention seemed to be caught by something. She sent a quick, surprisingly sharp glance in Moist's direction and gave the cushions a final pat before straightening up and smiling sweetly. The moment, whatever it was, most definitely had passed. Moist's brain was soggy with tiredness, and the natural ability to read tiny signals that had kept him alive on so many occasions had deserted him hours before. Even so, he had to ask. "Mrs. Simnel, is something wrong?" She cut him short. "Nay, lad, I were just thinking how strange it is that someone so small and, well, hairy, could be a king. But happen that's the disguise. I'm sure he'll look reet fine in his crown and glitter when he's back on his scone. Now, you need a bed, my lad." Tired though he was, Moist could recognise a deflection tactic and carried on. "Mrs. Simnel, is there something you're not—" "Nay, there's nothing, nothing for you to worry about at any rate." Moist's thoughts were in a whirl, but then further thoughts were blown away by the sound of the front door being blown open as Dick arrived with water streaming off his gabardine and greeted his mother. He was carrying so many bundles and boxes that he had to deposit them all in the little hallway where a shiny old clock told the time, the days of the week, and quite possibly the phase of the moon for that night.
But most of all, it was there to show the world that Dick Simnel's mother got the very best things he could buy for her. She was in his arms immediately, scattering parcels, but he managed to shake her off, laughing. Seated in the still, warm kitchen of the little house, Dick scoffed the congealed peas pudding while she unpacked some of the parcels.
"That's gradely, Alma. It's blowing up something cruel out there."
Moist suddenly realised he was dog-tired. Mrs. Simnel said,
"I've made him a bed for you, Mr. Litvig. I had one made up for King, but he looks comfortable where he is, and I don't want to disturb him now. Will you be stopping for the night, our Dick?"
"Sorry, Mother, no, no, too much to do. We're all on double shifts."
Mrs. Simnel looked at Moist proudly.
"That's my lad. He's a worker, my boy, what with his tiddling stick."
"That's a sliding ruler, Mother," Simnel said, grinning at Moist.
"Aye, well," said the proud parent. "He's making his way in the world, is my lad, working for that Harry King."
And she went to kiss Dick, who picked her up and kissed her in mid-air and put her back down again, leaving her slightly more wet and greasy than before.
"Oh, Mother," he said, "don't make me out to be some kind of saint. I'm just another working man with filthy hands. Any road, I have to get going, you know how it is."
On his way out, Dick looked in at the King and said,
"Is he okay, Mother?"
Moist watched Mrs. Simmel's face very carefully.
"He's gradely, lad," she replied. "He just needs his sleep. Such a shame to wake him up."
Dick flashed a glance to Moist as his mother said that, and seemed to be entertaining a thought, and then shrugged like a man who had thought better about it. He handed Moist a parcel of clean clothes for himself and the King, and then kissed his mother again.
"You will see to it, won't you, Mother, that they leave in time for the Zemphis Express?"
And she did, after a bowl of porridge, hot and sugary, just the kind Adora Bell totally disliked. Moist could feel it sticking to his bones as he and the King, smiling and rejuvenated after their nap, left the haven of Mrs. Simnel's little house as the sun began to rise over Stow Lat. In a cavern somewhere near the gloomy, somewhat twisted metropolis of Slake, the Grags were discussing the railway menace and ways of stopping it. They had found an artificer who liked working iron, and since he was a dwarf from Ankh-Morpork, he was in a position to explain matters to them. Sitting nervously in the dimly lit cavern and trying to appear to be very much on the side of the Grags while, of course, being on the side of the money, the artificer explained that locomotives are heavy and derailing them might be best left to when a train was heading through gorges or near the mountains. And he suggested that an alternative would be to deprive the engines of the basic necessities, fuel and water, and then attack them when they were most vulnerable. He had, fortuitously, come across a map that showed the locations of all the coal bunkers and water cranes and towers, and this he now produced.
"And just supposing we set our sights on stopping a particular train, how many people do we need to take down these water cranes?"
croaked an anonymous Grag in the darkness.
"You'll need plenty of you on this," said the helpful dwarf. "The opposition is probably bright enough to realise that you'll be focusing your efforts on disabling the engines, and will have the cranes and bunkers well guarded. Of course," he added, "when you're up high in the mountains, you have the advantage on them."
The artificer looked hopeful after this, insofar as he could be seen in the dark cavern, and said,
"Well, that's about it, sirs. It's not very difficult, but you know where to contact me if you need me."
In truth, the cavern was giving him the heebie-jeebies, and he wanted to be out of there as soon as possible. He heard the voice of the leader saying,
"Well done, my friend. Please take this gold as a token of appreciation. And yes, we do know where to find you, and every member of your family as well."
The artificer looked into the heavy leather bag and was delighted.
"Very kind of you, sirs. I hope to help you again at some time in the future."
And he went away, happy with such big wages for so little real work. The Grags didn't know anything. It was like taking money off children, but he kept smiling and said goodbye and had his throat cut in the darkness by a delver before he'd even left the dripping chamber. After all, what Grag would hand over gold to an Ankh-Morpork dwarf? To a Grag, they were all unbelievers. Moist was aware, as he and the King made their way hurriedly from Mrs. Simnel's house back to the station, of the dark clerks keeping an eye on them, invisibly tracking them on either side. Yesterday's clothing had gone, and after a quick wash and brush-up, the King had the appearance of a dwarfish businessman, while Moist was scruffier,
looking like an engineer hurrying on his way to work. The cry from the porter announced, "Shortly to depart from Platform 1, the Altiplano Express, stopping at Big Cabbage for Brassica World and Zemphis for Zemphis Falls, sleeping compartments at the front of the train, all aboard, ladies and gentlemen." Moist whispered to the king, "You know what to do, sire." The king showed his ticket to the guard, who looked at it very carefully before saying gruffly, "Middle class, middle of the train." Moist walked off as fast as he could and didn't look around. Looking around pegged you as a nervous person. You had to rely on instinct alone. Everybody knew what to do. He had to manoeuvre to get out of the way of crates of chickens, and he thought, why are there always crates of chickens? By the sound of it, they didn't really want to be there. And now it seemed that chickens were going everywhere. A mother with a child hurried past. A goblin waved to presumably his wife, although it was quite hard to tell with goblins, and Moist glanced at the guard and savoured, just for one moment, the silence before the train came alive. He embarked via the guard's van, and the first person he met was Detritus, without his badge, and therefore being, well, just another troll. He looked uncomfortable. Behind Detritus, Moist found Commander Vimes dressed as a guard, apparently thoroughly enjoying himself, if Moist correctly interpreted his twisted grimace. Vimes waved a clacks flimsy and said cheerfully, "The idiots! They tried their tricks while they were still on Ankh-Morpork soil. Poor souls! I suppose they thought they were outthinking us, but Cheery and Erlads had the measure of them in swift order. Sir Harry's men too, by the sound of it. And now both lots are heading for the Tanty, where the Dark Clerks will be engaging them in important discussions. Let's hope the news doesn't get out to the Grag Command just yet." It was going to be a long haul to Zemphis, and after Zemphis they'd be launching on to the new track, which no passenger train had yet travelled. Time enough to worry about that when they got there, Moist told himself firmly. For now, disguise was crucial. He must be the engineer, the lucky man who got to ride the latest Mark II flyer every day and get paid for it. As Moist walked up and down the carriages, he began to look at the passengers around him. Amongst the normal mix of Ankh-Morporkians and other folk from the Stowe Plains and surrounding areas whom he would expect to see on the regular journey to Zemphis, there were some dwarfs, travelling both together and singly. A few he recognised as part of the Low King's entourage. Others were, if he was any judge, Ankh-Morpork dwarfs. Mind you, there was more than one kind of Ankh-Morpork dwarf. One sort were happy at being Ankh-Morpork citizens, and others seemed to feel grumpy and nervous about their status, not realising that in Ankh-Morpork nobody paid much attention to what you were, unless you looked wealthy, in which case you would definitely be the centre of attention. And then there were the people trying a little too hard to present themselves as harmless members of the public. They always stood out, and Moist wondered if they knew how obvious they were to the trained eye of the suspicious scoundrel. They were worried, and trying desperately not to look worried, and nonchalance, real nonchalance, is very hard to fake. If you didn't have the knack, it cried out, "Amateur." One dwarf in particular had caught Moist's eye as he passed, so he came back a short while later and took the seat opposite. As Moist sat, rocking with the rhythm of the train, he sensed some discordance. Not fear, exactly, but the pulse of fear squashed down so heavily that it was almost singing. And in the privacy of Moist's skull, the ticker tape of suspicion ticked away. Moist had been clever so far, not staring, and indeed trying to look like a person who was not trying not to stare, a professional nonchalant. But the dwarf, who was under his eyes, was sweating. Sooner or later, something was going to break. "Oh, I know who you are," said Moist suddenly, keeping his voice low. "You're one of those train spotters, aren't you? I never forget an anorak."
"Oh, yes, I'm a very keen train spotter, sir," said the dwarf, keeping his voice level while his beard dripped sweat and his eyes screamed, "Help!" "Excellent! So you'd know the top speed of a flyer, then, would you?" "No?"
Hardly anyone on the train had looked up as he subtly questioned the dwarf, as subtly as a sledgehammer. It had become an extraordinary rule of railway etiquette, in that it went against every instinct of a born and bred Ankh-Morporkian, that other passengers' conduct and conversation remained their private business, however obtrusive it might be. The dwarf had visibly jumped in his seat when Moist first engaged him, but he was still grave-faced, and, yes, still sweating, so Moist carried on like a friend who wants to borrow money. "As I said, I never forget an anorak. Taking the long haul to Zemphis, are we?" The dwarf nodded and said simply, "Yes." "Did you see which engine we've got?" said Moist. "I tell you what, I'm hearing some trunnion rattle. Can you feel it? Maybe she's a new one just out of the yard."
Yes, I suppose so," spluttered the wretched dwarf.
As he considered his next move, Moist looked around. Ah, there was another dwarf further away, surreptitiously watching him watch the ersatz train spotter. Thinking furiously, he turned his attention back to the sweating dwarf in front of him. "Hang on, I've seen you before, haven't I? At the gates of the compound with your little notebook? We all have our little notebooks, buddy, and mine's in my luggage over there, and yours is the cleanest anorak I've ever seen. Real train spotters get covered in muck and smuts. It's their badge of honour to have a greasy anorak. But you, mister, know nothing about trains or train spotting, do you?" As he said this, he saw the other dwarf leave his seat and start to walk nonchalantly to the next carriage. "You! Wait there!" Moist barked at the dwarf in front of him as he ran after and jumped on the perambulating dwarf. There were screams of consternation from the other passengers, finally jolted from their careful lack of interest, as Moist rolled off, scrambled to his feet, and kicked the dwarf heavily with his plate-layer's boots, the ones with the metal toe-caps, an invitation to lie on the ground in agony, even if you were wearing chainmail. Moist reached up and pulled the communication cord. Some months before, Mr. Reg Shu, travelling in an otherwise empty compartment, had got his fingers trapped when the carriage window shot up unexpectedly fast, and by the time the train reached the terminus, he'd lost the top joint of one digit. Mr. Shu, being a zombie, though indignant, was merely inconvenienced by this accident, but at Effie's insistence, Simnel had devised the communication cord, a small rope that ran the length of the train with a bell attached to either end. If there was a problem, a passenger could pull this rope, and the driver or guard, alerted by the bell, would slam on the brakes. Moist reached up and pulled the communication cord, hardly visible overhead, and as the train slid to a screeching halt, he shouted to the passengers, "Nobody gets off this train unless they can fly. We'll soon have company, ladies and gentlemen. This will be something to tell your grandchildren about." Reinforcements were already coming from both directions, dark clerks from one and City Watch from the other, this particular portion of the City Watch being Commander Vimes, who took one look and said to everyone present, "Nothing to worry about, ladies and gentlemen. This gentleman hadn't bought a ticket for his journey, and that kind of behaviour makes our railway staff very upset." A little later, in the guard's van, the nervous young dwarf and his saturnine minder were amazingly talking to old Stoneface, who was sitting at the guard's desk and listening intently. "Now, gentlemen, something is going on here." He held up a large four-sided knife. The weapon really meant business. Not just business, but business with ignominy. The young dwarf was being held between two coppers as the commander spoke to him, smiling like a shark. "This, sir, is what assassins call a roundel, and I must tell you that even the professional killers don't use them. I believe they think it's cruel and has no finesse. Frankly, I think I'll agree about that. And I'm wondering, sir, why you're carrying it on this train." Vimes turned to the other dwarf, presently chained to Sergeant Detritus. "And you, sir, what was your part in all this? We're on a moving vehicle, travelling through wilderness where anything could happen. And you know, anything might happen very soon if I don't get some answers." He turned to an officer and said, "Fred, you and Nobby shackle the young one and drag him somewhere where he can be alone with his thoughts, and then I'll continue my little chat with this old fella, who I suspect would very much like to talk to me in a clear, thoughtful and expansive way, leaving nothing out. You, sir," and this was to Moist, "I suggest you go back to your seat. I'll talk to you later." Dismissed, and with nothing better to do, Moist resumed his patrol of the carriages. There were long, long miles to Zemphis ahead of them, and in some stretches the landscape was so monotonous that another term would have to be devised. To pass the time, he wandered along to the fabled first-class sleeping compartments. Effie had clearly had a hand in these, Whole families in Ankh-Morpork, including aunts and uncles, grannies and grandads, and all the kids, and possibly their donkey, could have slept well in just one of the delightful part-bedroom, part-drawing-rooms. And when Moist came back to the guard's van after pacing the corridors and gave the not-very-secret knock, he found the door opened by Nobby Nobbs, a watchman who, though technically human, with a certificate to prove it, was so much like a goblin that he had acquired a goblin girlfriend. Adorabelle had met her many times, and she had told Moist that Shine of the Rainbow was throwing herself away on Nobby.
"Watch her, Mr. Litvig. You should have been here when Mr. Vimes was interrogating that old suspect. He rolled up his sleeve and the dwarf went mental, and I mean proper mental. He saw that mark, you know, the one on the commander's wrist, and went, well, totally mental, promising absolutely everything. Never seen anyone so scared in all my life, and Vimesy hadn't even touched him. He broke, sir. That's the only way I can put it. He broke. I mean, he's had a go at me on occasions, you know, about such things as what I found on the street and was hurrying to give back to their owner and such like. Nothing important. But that dwarf, it was like he melted, sir. Melted. You wouldn't know Danny Duncan not being in the watch, sir. Well, the poor bugger owns up to anything just to get a drink and a place to sleep in the cells and maybe a chat and a ham sandwich. But this lawn ornament, he's got it worse.
Moist looked around.
Where are they now? In there. And Mr. Vimes took the young'un off somewhere else with Fred.
Nobby pointed towards the far end of the guard's van.
Mr. Litvig, you know that great idea you had?
Moist hesitated.
Help me, Nobby, I have a lot of great ideas.
Right, sir. The one about sorting the mail on the train, sir.
And Moist thought, oh, yes, and it would work. But Nobby carried on.
Well, there's a special carriage on this train. It has shelves and pigeonholes and everything.
Inside the mail carriage, Moist saw the commander and his new little friend with Fred Colon. Vimes was talking quite cheerfully to the young dwarf, and when he saw Moist, he gave a quick gesture, indicating that he could listen but shouldn't disturb the delicate process. There were no signs of fighting or nastiness of any kind, and there were two cups of coffee nestling in the wire pigeonholes. The commander, as soothingly as a mother with a new baby, played a theme that put Moist von Litvig, confidence trickster, liar, cheat, fraud, swindler, and king of slyness, the sort that dripped like a venom of a striking cobra, to shame.
Oh, dear, those grags. Tell me now, which one was it? Come on, help me now. I can't remember. And they did what? Surely not. Oh, was it your chum that we have in the van next door, was it? Well, it might have been, yes.
Moist wanted to applaud, but the show, if that's what it was, kept on going. And now, with the strange red snake glistening on his arm, the commander crooned oh so carefully that a grandmother's tea party would appear to be a smash-and-grab raid in comparison. And it finished with a sigh as the commander said, with magnificently sincere anguish,
"Of course, if it was up to me. But, you see, I have to deal with Lord Veterinarian the Low King. I could put in a good word for you, my lad, telling him how helpful you've been. Yeah, I think I'll do just that. And I thank you for helping me, and I can assure you..."
And here the glowing snake moved as the commander did. "I can assure you, young man, that no matter what happens to you, nothing will happen to your family. But I don't think I'll be able to persuade people of your innocence if you're caught like this at any future time, or, indeed, if you turn out to be lying to me. And now, if you don't mind, I need to talk to your colleague again." Moist loved that, "if you don't mind," as if the fool had a choice. And Dark Clarks whisked the young dwarf away and came back with the older dwarf, when the careful, methodical interrogation continued, but in a louder voice, considering that this dwarf was much older. The words that Vimes used had more menace in them now, but nevertheless he half suggested that everything would get better if the dwarf in front of him told the commander absolutely everything he knew about the Grags and Delvers and his fellow conspirators, who'd been duped into being the ones who got caught and thrown to the Low King's justice.
"You, sir, you'll be sent for trial before the Low King, but, as I said, I'll put in a good word for you. At the next station, I'll send a clax if your one-time friends haven't burnt down the tower."
And that made him flinch. Moist had to try hard not to applaud.
"Fred," said the commander,
Please ask them to bring in this gentleman's accomplice, so that they can enjoy each other's company for the rest of their journey." And when both dwarfs were in the mail coach, under the watchful eye of the dark clerks, Vimes continued.
"Okay," he said in the same cheerful tone. "I'm sorry about the manacles, but we can't have you running away now, can we? And the pair of you must remember, especially you, sir, at your age, it could have been so much worse. I'm afraid to say that it might still turn out that way anyway, but as I said, I'll put in a good word. You'll be looked after until I can arrange for you to be taken off under guard. And if anything jogs your memory, don't hesitate to tell them, and I'll see what I can do. But I'm sure you'll agree that it'll be for the safety of all parties, especially your own, if in the meantime you are held in this sealed room where nobody can hurt you. I'll see to it myself that you have regular meals and refreshments." He turned to Moist and said, "A word with you, please, outside." Back in the guards' van, the commander pulled a cigar from somewhere and lit it in flagrant defiance of every railway law, sat down on the bench and said, "Mr. Lipwig, you look quizzical. Feel free to speak." "Well, Commander, I'm impressed you did such a number on them. They think you're their friend, that you want to help them." This was met by another puff of smoke. "But of course I'm their friend," replied Vimes, straight-faced. "And I will continue to be their friend, for now. You are a rascal, and I am not. Oh, yes, I could make their lives impossible, or even worse. The older one you introduced to the railway boot so adroitly, well, he's the brains of this particular outfit. And the little one is what they call a cat's paw, an idiot, filled to the brim with lies, exciting lies, telling him that he is doing the work of tack. I mean, he isn't even a good train spotter." Vimes patted his pocket and said, "And now I have names, oh, such names, such wonderful names. And when the facts of life are explained to their owners, they'll undoubtedly lead to other names, and we shall see the bunny rabbits run. Police work isn't all about kicking down doors, you know. It's about getting to the bottom of things. And once you're right on the bottom, you see all the way to the top. And the top is what I'm after here. We'll be stopping for coal and water at a place called Cranberry very soon, and there should be a Clax Tower." He smiled. "I wonder what his lordship will say about my lovely list of names. I reckon he'll go right past acerbic en route to ironic, and end up slap-bang in sardonic without even taking a breath." He slapped his pocket again. "I know some of these, don't I just? All-powerful dwarfs, such stalwart defenders of the low king on the one hand, and dealing happily with the grags on the other. Thank you very much, Mr. Lipwig. You're a loss to crime prevention. But you recognise the process because you recognise yourself, isn't that right?" "How useful. So do I. The Mark must always think of you as his friend, and you yourself must be as a sorrowful yet loving father. The Mark's shield from the dreadful darkness outside." The commander turned and said, "Nobby, who's on duty at Big Cabbage Station?"
"Sergeant Willard, Mr. Vimes."
Vimes said to Moist, "That'll do.
He's an old copper, and he'll have his hurry-up wagon, and he'll get them in front of his lordship in no short order. And with them still in shackles, he won't have any problems. You know, I almost feel sorry for them. Grags, delvers, whatever they call themselves, the modus operandi is to find some innocent dwarf with the right connections and let it be known to him or her that if they do not toe the line and do what they are told, then perhaps all of their family will simply disappear into the gap." He smiled and said, "Come to think of it, that's exactly what I do. But I'm a teddy bear by comparison and on the right side." Vimes stood up and waved his arms a bit for the circulation and said, "And now I think I need to go and see the king about my interesting findings. And don't worry, I'll put in a good word too. You pay attention to people, and that's a skill in itself." The outside air was permeating the carriages now with the scent of the Stowe Plains, which consisted of one scent, and that was cabbage, or cabbage-like. And it was a sad smell. It drooped helplessness. Melancholy. Mind you, the cabbages themselves were excellent, especially the newer varieties. The town of Big Cabbage, theoretically the last place any sensible person would want to visit, was nevertheless popular throughout the summer because of the attractions of Brassica World and the Cabbage Research Institute, whose students were the first to get a cabbage to a height of 500 yards, propelled entirely by its own juices. Nobody asked why they felt it was necessary to do this,
But that was science for you, and of course, students. As soon as the train arrived at Platform 2 at Big Cabbage, several watchmen appeared alongside the guards' van. Moist looked on as Commander Vimes passed out the captives he had been so awfully kind to, and watched them whisked away under guard in the hurry-up wagon. As it disappeared, Vimes said to Moist, "We have the names and addresses of their families, and they'll have bodyguards day and night until this damn thing is over. I know Veterinari will huff and puff about the bill, but then whenever, doesn't he?" Right on schedule, the train pulled away from Big Cabbage, leaving the great, dirty, distant smog of Ankh-Morpork on the horizon far behind them. Moist had a constant feeling that he was going slightly uphill, which was at least moderately the truth. Things were running as they should, people were settling down for the long haul, and that gave him more time to think. Theoretically, he knew the time to worry was when things were going wrong, but his instinct had a tendency to worry when things were just too good to be true, and right now a cumulonimbus of worry was again building over his head. The anvil of the gods was just waiting to drop on him. What had he missed? What had he forgotten? No, everything was going to be all right. There was a bridge ahead with the usual troll on guard. The troll railway families treated the bridges, shiny and new as they were, as their own. Oh yes, a tunnel to a troll was a delightful walk in the park, but a bridge, your own bridge, especially one with toilet facilities courtesy of Harry King, and enough space to raise a family. Trolls, thought Moist. Who would have thought it? They keep their bridges sparkling. Indeed, Effie had announced a best-kept bridge contest for the troll bridges throughout the length of the Ankh-Morpork Railway, with no fewer than 20 goats for the winner.